for my clients, stopping the binging is always paramount before the weight starts to come off. There are people who can't lose weight for other reasons, particularly as I work with women that are going through menopause. A lot of people that I work with are 50 pounds or more overweight. And so usually I can get them down to about 10 or 15 pounds overweight. And then losing that last 10 or 15 pounds is rougher. Sometimes they have to decide, well, are they going to some societal standard that really doesn't have to do with health? And can you just soften up and you have a little belly and so what? And a lot of the work I do with people sometimes has to do with meeting in the middle like that.
Welcome to the Wealthy Wealthy Wise podcast. If you would like to listen in on thought-provoking conversations with countercultural thought leaders and experts in the fields of wealth, health, and relationships, the three keys to having what I call a wealthy, wealthy life, then this is the show for you. I'm Christina Wise, real estate investor, best-selling author of Falling for Money, and founder of Wealthy Wealthy, where I serve as your personal guide to money, health, and happiness. Welcome back to Wealthy Wealthy Wise. In this episode, I talk with Glenn Livingston. He is a PhD in psychology and the best-selling author of Never Binge Again. In this episode, he explains why and how the food industry designs and produces food with the intention to cause food addictions, leading to uncontrollable binge eating. Then he shares an exact methodology for how to break the addiction, making binge eating a thing of the past. So if you or anyone you know feels like they have a little bit of a food addiction or a tendency to binge eat, you'll certainly want to listen to this episode. This was a fun interview, as it's a subject I've never explored, and therefore I truly enjoyed his work. I hope you enjoy this too. Glenn, I'm so thrilled to be having this conversation with you today. So thank you for being on the Wealthy, Wealthy, Wise podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a delight. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Yeah, and thank you for being willing to reschedule. I know we bumped into some technical issues last time, so now we're good to go.
Yeah, it's par for the course on the internet. Yeah.
It's funny these days that you really have to just laugh at technology. You know, we're so dependent on it, but when it breaks, versus I used to get frustrated or just I'd be so...
I used to freak out.
Exactly.
No, as a matter of fact, I have a big program starting tomorrow and the software that runs the customer center is down. And so I'm going to have hundreds of screaming customers at me, you know, tomorrow morning. And you know what? It doesn't really even faze me because I'm thinking this happens to my competitors also. And it's just part of the course. It's just what happens.
So. It really is. So we just have to laugh. And I just want to say thank you for the flexibility, the great mood, because if we can all have great moods and flexible, then it just makes it that much better. And I really am at this stage of my life too, that I really am so open to whatever happens. And so there's a reason why maybe things break down, because now is a better time for us to connect and have a, you know, it's the timing is right. So anyway, thanks again for everything. And this is a conversation I've never had on air before, and it's really interesting. But before we dig into really your passion and your mission, I'd love to hear a little bit about who you are and your background, and a lot of it because the people I love to interview on my show are those that are a little unconventional, that are going against the grain, especially the grain of their industry, that are poking holes in the traditions of
that's me.
Yeah, that domain of study.
And that's
pretty much everyone I have on my program. So I loved yours, that you were really disillusioned in your own field of psychology. And obviously you went through a lot of training to get your PhD and a lot of turmoil. I mean, I know what I don't know personally, anecdotally, but I know a lot of my friends have PhDs and it's a lot of work and
a lot of sacrifice
for that achievement. So to go against some of that takes a lot of courage. And so I'd love for you to just share a little bit about you, your background, why psychology, and what caused the disillusion.
Okay. Well, the most important thing you should know, I'm from a family of psychologists. There are 17 therapists and social workers and psychologists and psychiatrists and counselors. And the running joke in the family is that if something breaks, we all know how to stand around and ask you how it feels, but nobody knows how to fix it. But all kidding aside, psychology is always been in my blood. From the time I was 4 years old and I heard my dad on the radio and I came running in, I said, "Mommy, why is daddy on the radio?" And she said, "Well, he's trying to make people happy when they're sad. That's what psychologists do." And I said, "But why on the radio?" And he said, "Because he wants to make more people happy when they're sad." And I was like, that's what I want to do. And, you know, I actually bugged my dad's office when I was 9 years old so I could listen to his sessions, which was totally illegal. But just to give you a sense of how much I really wanted to do that. And when it's important to understand that that was first and foremost what I wanted to do, because when I was about 17, I discovered this trick, which is that I'm 6'4", I'm reasonably muscular, and if I worked out for 2 or 3 hours a day, I could just eat whatever I wanted to eat. So 6, 7, 10,000 calories a day was not really a problem. 2 pizzas, boxes of muffins and munchkins and lattes and chocolate bars and anything else that wasn't nailed down. I kind of lived to work out and eat, which was great. Like Doug Graham said, it felt like a superpower. But when I got a little older and I got married and I had responsibilities and I had patients and I was commuting, I couldn't work out 3 hours a day and my metabolism slowed down a little bit. But I just couldn't stop eating the way that I was eating. It seemed like a way of life. And I got fatter and fatter and my triglycerides went through the roof. Like 1,100 doctors were telling me I was going to die by the time I was 30. I was very distraught about it. More importantly, when I was sitting and working with high-risk patients, like I almost specialized in working with suicidal adolescents. And you've got to be, it's not like working with a bug under a microscope. You've got to be 100% present. You've got to be emotionally there for them. You have to be committed. You have to be able to think about them afterwards for hours and talk to your supervisors and colleagues and peers. And I just wasn't. I mean, I never lost anybody, thank God, but I just wasn't. I was thinking, when can I go get another pizza? When can I go to the delicatessen and empty the contents of the tray into my mouth? And that was very disturbing to me. So being a psychologist from a family of therapists in New York, I knew a lot of the best people. So I went to some of the best psychologists around, some of the best psychiatrists around. I took medication. I went to Overeaters Anonymous. I even funded my own study, which eventually had 40,000 people go through it, on the internet in the days when the clicks were pretty cheap. And it was a very soulful journey. I learned a lot about myself. I don't regret doing it, but it just didn't help me to stop binging. I would get a little better and then it would get worse. And I get a little better and then it would get worse. And I'd like to tell you a story about what I found out in that study and then how I followed up on that so that you understand why the traditional, gee, try to love yourself then. It's not what you're eating, it's what's eating you, which is what psychology tells you. I'm pausing for a second because it's not really what the evidence in psychology tells you, but it's the consensus in the community. What I found from the study, I found that people who struggled with chocolate had a lot of trouble with loneliness or brokenheartedness in their life. I found that people who struggled with crunchy chewing things had a lot of trouble with stress at work, and people who struggled with like bagels and pasta and bread, they tended to have stress at home. And I thought that was really interesting and insightful. And I was in a bad marriage at the time, and I really was feeling lonely and brokenhearted. I'm divorced now, but at the time I was committed, and I started trying to figure out, well, where is this coming from, and how did that pattern get set up? That if I feel lonely and brokenhearted, I'm running to chocolate. My binges always started with chocolate. So I went to my mom, who was also a therapist, and I said, "Mom, is there anything in my upbringing? You know, I'm in a bad marriage, but is there anything in my upbringing that could have set this pattern up?" And she got this horrible look on her face. And I said, "What's the matter, Mom?" And she said, "Honey, I'm so sorry." And I had to coax it out of her. And she said, "Well, when you were about 1 year old, my father, your grandfather, had just gotten out of prison. And he was guilty. And I didn't know it. And I adored him. And he was my whole world. And I was just devastated. I went to a deep depression. And at the same time, your father and my husband was a captain in the army, and they were talking about sending him to Vietnam, and I was terrified. Here I am, a mother with no job, and I was going to be, you know, single, a widow. It was horrible. And so when you would come to me crying or hungry or needing to be held, I would say, honey, go get your Bosco. And I put a bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup in a refrigerator on the floor. And I would say, honey, go get it. And you go running over to the refrigerator and you'd suck on the bottle and you go into a chocolate sugar coma. So, Christine, if this were the movies, the way the story would unfold after that would be mom and I would have a big hug and a big cry, and I'd never have trouble with chocolate again, right? That's what would happen, because that's what happens in the movies. We had a hug and a cry, metaphorically, we're on the telephone. And it was a valuable conversation to have because I could forgive myself. I understood what was happening. I could forgive her. I could learn a lot more about her life and what she was terrified of. And she was 24 years old. I mean, what do you know when you're 24 years old? With my apologies to all the 24-year-olds who might be listening right now. But really, she was a kid. So I forgave her. But it didn't make the binging better. It made it worse. And here's why. It's like there was this little voice in my head. And that little voice said something like this. Hey, Glenn, you're right. Your mama didn't love you enough. And she left a big chocolate-sized hole in your heart. And until you can find the love of your life, you better go right on binging. Let's go get some more now. Yippee, let's go do it. So the emotions became a justification for the binge. I learned a couple of things about that. First of all, it's not necessarily critical to be a detective or a psychologist to figure out how to stop binging. What's critical is to recognize that voice of justification that lets the emotional fire jump out into your life and become a binge. There's always that voice of justification, even if you can't hear it. And it's a lot quicker to disempower that voice. Now, simultaneous with all of this, I had a dual career. My ex-wife traveled for business. We never had kids. I worked at home. I had a lot of time. So I was also doing a lot of consulting for Big Food and Big Pharma. I'm a little embarrassed about having done that now. Because I think they're not really on the right side of health and wellness and everything like that. And I knew that they were spending billions of dollars to create these hyper-palatable concentrations of starch and sugar and fat, salt and oil and excitotoxins to find our bliss point. They want to find the point of maximal pleasure. Well, there's a little fruit fly, sorry. Of maximal pleasure without giving you enough nutrition to make you feel satisfied. As a matter of fact, there was a major food bar manufacturer who told me, one of the VPs, told me that their biggest insight was to take the vitamins out of the bar because they were interfering with that pleasurable taste and to put the money into the packaging, making it look healthy instead. And that's iconic for what happens in the food industry. Now, if you look at the animal studies, I'm a vegan now and I'm kind of against these kind of studies, but back then they were done. If you look at the animal studies that show you what happens when you supersize stimuli or you short circuit the pleasure machinery that evolution prepared us for. So for example, if you put an electrode in an animal's brain in the pleasure center and you wire that to a lever and you let that animal press the lever whenever it wants to, what happens is that animal will press that lever thousands of times per day to the exclusion of its survival needs. A starving rat will ignore food and keep pressing the pleasure button. A nursing mother rat will ignore her pups and press the pleasure button all day long. Rats will crawl over painful electrical grids to find that pleasure button and press it all day. So the supersized stimuli that we are being presented with, maybe they're not putting electrodes into our brains, but is it a far cry to imagine that if you can walk out of one McDonald's and there's another McDonald's across the street, that we're in a state of mind at this point where there are pleasure buttons all around us and people say, I just don't like fruit and vegetables anymore. We're ignoring our survival needs in favor of all of these pleasure buttons. Our survival drives have been hijacked. And see, there are actually two parts of the brain. So this is how I finally got out of it. There's the lower brain or the brain stem, the lizard brain. And that's really the seat of addiction. That's the seat of the fight or flight response. That's the part of us that perceives feast and famine. And when the lizard brain sees something in the environment, picture like this is the brain stem, it says, do I eat it? Do I mate with it? Or do I kill it? It's eat, mate, or kill. There's no love there. There's no concern for tribe or family or religion or spirituality or art or music or community contribution or your kids or anything like that. It's just eat, mate, or kill. It's the mammalian brain and in particular the neocortex that have evolved millions of years after that. And by the way, if there's any reason you don't believe in evolution, it doesn't matter if God put it there. This is the way the anatomy works. It evolved after that to slow down the lizard brain and say, you know, whoa there, big guy, before you eat, mate, or kill, how is this going to affect our loved ones? How is this going to affect our long-term goals? How is this going to affect everything that we want to accomplish in our life, including our weight loss plans? This is why, so the brain is really of two parts. This is why you're always changing your mind about your best laid plans. This is why you can read a diet book over the weekend, and then Monday morning, you're online in front of a chocolate bar at Starbucks, and the closer you get, the more this voice is talking to you in your head and saying, you know, you really worked out hard today, and you could start tomorrow. Or, gee, chocolate comes from a cocoa bean, and cocoa bean grows on a plant, and therefore chocolate is a vegetable, right? There are a lot of vegetables, and it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but reason and rationality is in the upper brain. So the lizard brain is the target of addiction. It's the part of us that gets hijacked and makes a biological error to go for all of these industrial products and the things that, you know, there were no bagels on the savannah, there was no pasta on the savannah, there was no pizza on the savannah, there were no chocolate bars on the savannah. We had fruit and vegetables and maybe some you know, natural game and protein. And life from the industrial side of the world is really about a bunch of heavy guys in white suits with mustaches that are laughing all the way to the bank every time that they get you to reject your best thinking and use the lizard brain. And this is why, by the way, I think that we need to start to turn shame into anger, and we need to kind of stand up and say, whoa, I can opt out of this whole scenario. I don't have to go along with making those fed bankers happy all the time, right? Okay, so how did this all come together for me? I'm trying to do this all in a short period of time because I know we're a little time constrained. This is the embarrassing part for me, because after 3 decades of tremendous suffering, I was about 55 pounds heavier, and I had psoriasis and eczema on it. I looked awful, and I really was miserable. It was almost like not having a life. But after 3 decades of suffering, I came across some alternative addiction treatment which talked about the two sides of the brain and made it really clear that you can't love yourself out of an addiction. That doesn't mean you shouldn't love yourself. I'm in favor of all of the nurture and the wounded child type of work, but you can't, that's not the cure for an addiction. So the cure for the addiction is to capture and cage this rabid animal. And you have to learn to separate your human identity from it and hear it at the moment of impulse. Now he worked most, this is Jack Trimpe at Rational Recovery, and he worked mostly with the black and white addictions, like, you know, like cigarettes and alcohol and drugs, the things that you could quit entirely. I had to make a tremendous amount of modifications in order to make this work for food. But here's what I did. I said, this inner lizard brain thing, I'm going to call that my pig just to have shorthand. That's my inner pig. I'm going to draw a really clear line in the sand. Like, I will never eat chocolate on a weekday again. Not a guideline, but a rule. I will never have, and there's a reason for that, I'll tell you afterwards. I'll never have chocolate on a weekday again. And then I would say, if chocolate on a weekday is pig slop, if I heard my pig squealing for slop during the week, like saying, oh, you worked out really hard and you can have it. Well, that's pig squeal. I don't listen. I don't eat pig slop, and I don't listen to farm animals tell me what to do. So this sophisticated psychologist who published all these papers and then tens of millions of dollars consulting for industry. The way that I actually figured out was, I don't eat pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And as primitive as that sound, as ridiculous as that sounds, as embarrassing as it is, that's what gave me those extra microseconds at the moment of impulse to wake up and realize who I was, the kind of person I wanted to be around chocolate or other tempting foods, and make the right decisions. It wasn't a miracle. It was a process, and over time, I had to refine the rules, and, you know, I got better and better at hearing those squeals. I got better and better at disempowering them because I did more research into how the pig was lying to me. And I kept a journal for 8 years. I never intended to share it with anybody, Christina. I really thought this is just how I personally recovered. I wasn't working with eating disordered people. I would specifically refer them out for the most part because I felt like I had a problem myself. But I got better, and I was a minor part of a publishing company as part of my work. And the CEO said they needed a book to publish to do some marketing tests with. And I was getting divorced, and I needed something to do that I didn't didn't think was going to be really big. And at first I said, you're out of your mind. I'm not going to get up and say there's a pig inside me in public. And he said, no, this is great. I'm going to use it too, because he had to lose 80 pounds, and he eventually did. And it took off. And now we have 600,000 readers, and it's often the number one book for weight loss and weight management on the Free Kindle side. And I've got a whole coaching network. And now this is what I do, is I help people. They don't have to call it a pig. They can call it a food monster. But I help them fight their lizard brain, identify and disempower those voices. Now, it turns out, because you started this by asking me, how was I disillusioned with the field of psychology? Well, I offer this as coaching and education as opposed to psychological treatment, because I don't want to be subject to the constraints and oversight of psychological treatment. But if you look at the research and what's actually working for binge eating, it's much more cognitive behavioral than psychodynamic. And cognitive behavioral means identifying irrational thoughts and disempowering those irrational thoughts. If you ask most psychologists how to overcome binge eating disorder, they will tell you that it's a complex phenomenon, and you really have to identify the deep emotional conflicts and teach people other coping mechanisms. I think that's all good work, and it makes people more comfortable and more motivated. And I think that excess food does have an analgesic effect. If you have too much food in your body and your body's at war with it, then your nervous system has less of an ability to conduct the emotions. And so it is possible to escape emotional conflict by overeating. But people take the leap and say, well, emotional conflict is the cause of overeating. No, that's not true. Emotional conflict is the cause of discomfort, of psychic pain, and justification. The illogical thoughts that make it okay to break your best laid plans is the cause of the overeating. It's a very important distinction, because what it says is, it doesn't matter how big a fire you have inside you, it's quicker and easier to build a better fireplace and contain it. And it's going to be easier to put out the fire once it's contained anyway. So I tell people, it's not necessary to figure out why your mama didn't love you or contemplate your navel in order to stop overeating. Let me help you to very clearly define for yourself. I'm not going to tell you what to eat. You can do this with any diet. Define for yourself exactly where the line is between healthy and unhealthy eating. And let me help you listen to your inner food monster or your inner pig trying to get you to cross it, and show you how to disempower those thoughts. That's a lot faster in my experience than doing the 5 or 10 years of psychotherapy required to change people's emotional character and make those deep emotional reactions stop happening in the level that they do. So that's how I'm different than my profession. My profession will also tell you that you should use guidelines as opposed to rules. Just try to eat well 90% of the time. The problem with that is that all the research on willpower says that willpower is not a black and white switch. It's a fatigable muscle. It's the ability to make good decisions in the face of overwhelming pleasure. And there are only so many good decisions you can make over the course of the day. It's like gas in the tank. It wears down with every decision that you make. Not just decisions about food, by the way. If you give people math problems to do, they have more trouble resisting marshmallows afterwards than if they got to breathe deeply and not think about anything. Decisions burn brain glucose. There seems to be a muscle in the brain that needs the glucose to feed on. And that's why you have more trouble at night than you do in the morning. Now, If you have a guideline that says, well, I'm going to eat well 90% of the time, or let's even say, I'm aware that I'm speaking quickly. Let's even say I will eat chocolate 10% of the time, and I will not eat chocolate 90% of the time. Every time you're in front of a chocolate bar, you have to decide, is this part of the 10% or 90%? You're burning your willpower. Let's make a rule instead. I only eat chocolate on weekends. What you're really saying is, I'm the kind of person who never eats chocolate during the week. It's really a character decision. Character is your deep-seated, habitual way of deciding what to do in certain situations without even thinking about it. It obviates the need for willpower. So I'm not really asking people to rely on more willpower. This is where they get in trouble and where they keep falling down. I'm asking them to think through the kind of person that they want to be in these dangerous situations where they keep falling down, and make very clear rules as opposed to the guideline regarding who that person is, and then say, I am becoming this kind of person. You know, it's okay. We talk about mistakes afterwards, but I was disillusioned with my profession. I had some different ways of going about it, and so far, I still have a license.
So. Well, that's really good. You said a lot there, and I was really intently listening, and it makes a lot of sense that, sure, we have feelings, but it's our cognitive ability to actually make decisions. But to your point, so much of this is around willpower. If I just had more willpower, and yes, we only have so much willpower points per day that get used up, like you said. But what if I hear what you're saying correctly, it's that by creating some rules that we follow ourselves, that enables us to break the patterns regardless of how we're feeling. So maybe we're feeling sad and lonely or whatever the case may be, that in many cases, the comfort food might be go and eat a half a gallon of ice cream. But if it's, no, I'm feeling this again, but my rule is I don't eat ice cream during the weekdays. You're not going to fall victim to that, even though you might be in that emotional state, which we all get to a certain emotional state.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the second piece of it is asking yourself, what is the biological need that's driving the craving? Because it's usually an authentic biological need. When a smoker confuses smoke for oxygen, if they will go outside and take three deep breaths of cool mountain air, the craving for the cigarette goes away. You're not supposed to believe me about any of this, by the way. You're just supposed to try it. Because every bone in your body will tell you that I'm full of it. But feelings aren't facts. When I first started resisting my craving for chocolate because I decided I wanted to be the kind of person who didn't need chocolate, I would go and have a big smoothie with leafy green lettuce and bananas, like a half pound of leafy green lettuce and a couple of bananas. And at first I thought, you know, get out of my way, I want the chocolate, I'm going to kill someone. Because remember, this is a survival drive. It's not a low-level thought. It's almost like you feel like you're starving for oxygen and you're going to suffocate if you don't have this. But I told myself that feelings weren't facts and that the chocolate was fake flap. And so I went and I made myself a banana smoothie with greens anyway. And I didn't get high with the food in the same way that I got high with chocolate, because chocolate is not just something we eat for comfort. It's an artificial concentration of, theobromine and other stimulants and sugar and fat and, you know, and dairy. And there's a natural high, not a natural, there's an unnatural high that occurs after you have a lot of the industrial products for only about 18 minutes. By the way, you want to think about the next time you're going for that. So I didn't get that. But I also didn't feel like I had to get up on top of a clock tower and throw things at people if I didn't get my chocolate. The craving went away. And a weird thing happened after I did that about a dozen times. I no longer had chocolate cravings. I had banana smoothie cravings. So what was I doing? I was retraining my biology to crave what it was supposed to crave in the first place. And then I started. Yeah.
So anybody listening that really struggles with binge eating, and obviously this is your specialty. And fortunately, I mean, we all have our vices, and binge eating's not been one of mine. So, but we all have something of this same nature. Your specialty happens to be binge eating. And when it comes to weight loss, we know a lot of people struggle with weight. So question one is, let's say, weight loss, if you're in a place where you desire to have weight loss, how much of that is connected to binge eating? Meaning, is it all associated with binge eating, that people can't lose weight? I mean, outside of some maybe hormonal issues or some things that are going on, that even if you eat the healthiest diet, there's other issues. But assuming just an inability to lose weight or keep weight off, is it all associated to binge eating, if you will?
Well, for my clients, I attract people who feel like they can't stop eating beyond their own best judgment. So for my clients, stopping the binging is always paramount before the weight starts to come off. There are people who can't lose weight for other reasons, particularly as I work with women that are going through menopause, it usually if they're, a lot of people that I work with are 50 pounds or more overweight. And so usually I can get them down to about 10 or 15 pounds overweight. And then losing that last 10 or 15 pounds is rougher. Sometimes they have to decide, well, are they going to some societal standard that really doesn't have to do with health? And can you just soften up and you have a little belly and so what? And a lot of the work I do with people sometimes has to do with meeting in the middle like that. The important thing to understand about the addiction to binging is that it's not just an addiction to binging, it's an addiction to dieting too. Because when you feel overtaken by your lizard brain, like you just have to eat, it's almost like someone's got a gun to your head and forcing you to open the refrigerator and pour things into your mouth, or you just have to have the chocolate or the bagel or the pizza. That's an activation of the fight or flight response. And if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, if your body and brain perceive that you go through periods of famine, where there's not enough nutrition and calories available, then the moment that nutrition and calories present themselves, it would make sense that there's a switch inside that says, hoard these, because you don't know when it's available again. And that's why so many people say being too full is a trigger for them to binge more. Otherwise, it doesn't make any rational sense. And so what you want to do to overcome binge eating is not to go on a juice fast for a week, because people get in a rush to take the weight off, but to, you know, have breakfast the morning after a binge, come up with a regular, reliable, nutritionally complete plan. You can check it at Chronometer or MyFitnessPal or something like that. And eat, you know, at least three times a day, every day on a regular basis, no matter what. You can make adjustments to what you're eating if the weight's not coming off, and you have to accept that it comes off slowly. You just have to accept that, because the more you try to get it off quickly, the more you're going to bounce back and wind up even heavier. And I could just see it over and over and over again. And I understand that. My mother died last year, and I loosened up my food plan a little bit, and I'm about 10 pounds over where I really like my fighting weight to be. I would like to be back to my fighting weight tomorrow, but I have to accept it's going to take me 10 weeks. So I really understand the desire to do that, but you can't. You just can't.
And what is your definition of binge eating? Is it that, like you said, meaning even though logically you're thinking I shouldn't eat this, but then you go ahead and do it anyway? One, and two, is it attached to bad food? I mean, could you binge eat on carrots, for example, or people wouldn't binge eat on carrots?
So I am in favor of having less debate about exactly where the line is between normal eating and healthy eating, and defining that line for yourself. So you could look at the DSM-5 diagnostic criteria for binge eating, and they would tell you that, yes, you're doing it if you're having episodes of eating beyond your own best judgment to discomfort, you know, several times per month. And if you have associated thoughts of like self-castigation and self-criticism afterward, and you can't let go of that, and you are rapidly gaining weight. And there's a whole bunch of criteria that could say, oh, you're a sickie, you're a binge eater versus you're not. But I don't think binge eating is a disease in the first place, so I don't think you have to be that concerned about whether you're over that line or not. I think that it behooves everyone to discover where that line is for themselves. So if you want to be able to have a bag of potato chips twice a week, and that's where the line is, then having one potato chip over that bag is, that means you missed the bullseye. That's all it means. It doesn't mean that you've fallen into another world where all of a sudden all bets are off and you might as well have another five bags that night and get back on tomorrow. It just means that you missed the mark. But if you think about an archery target, there are very clear delineations about where the bullseye is and isn't. You know exactly where the second rung is and where the third rung is. So maybe your rules are a little bit different for when you go out to dinner. Maybe your rules are a little bit different for when you're on vacation. But your rules, you know where they are. You know when you hit them. You know when you miss them. And you get up and you keep aiming again. Where people get in trouble, first of all, is they don't commit to the bullseye. They say, you know, progress, not perfection. And, you know, I don't want to commit 100% because if I miss it, I'm going to beat myself up too much. But that ignores the healthy role of having just a little bit of guilt after you make a mistake. if you touch a hot stove, you want to feel a little pain, because otherwise you're going to put your whole hand down it and burn yourself to death. And there are disorders which prevent children. There are children that are born that can't feel pain. And we don't keep those kids alive past 5 years old. It's like the inability to feel pain is the inability to learn from your environment. So you want to be able to feel it for a little while, but just enough to get your attention so you can make an adjustment so that you don't make the mistake again. Where we get in trouble is we allow our inner pigs to beat us up and say, oh my God, you're a pathetic hot stove toucher. You might as well put your whole hand down on the stove and just let it burn, because you're hopeless. You've got a disease. You know, if you chip a tooth by accident, you don't go get a hammer and bang the rest of the mouth. You know, you get to the dentist and you fix it. You are hiking up a mountain and you slip and fall. You don't say, screw it, I'm just going to roll all the way back down the mountain. You get up and you go back to it. We are set up as learning machines, right? And so if you keep aiming at the same bullseye the phrase I like to use is commit with perfection, but forgive yourself with dignity. So during the psychology of aim, during the psychology of commitment, it's really a 100% commitment, because anything less is not a commitment at all. Anything less is really saying, I'm just going to try for a little while until I don't feel like it anymore. I mean, if I asked you to marry me and I said, you know, I'm 98% certain that I'm not going to cheat, but there sure are a lot of attractive people out there. That's not really a proposal, right? We expect 100% in certain areas of life. We've got to be 100% certain that we're not going to go out and kick a policeman in the tush. We've got to be 100% certain that we don't run after attractive strangers in the street and kiss them. There are a lot of things that we have to know with 100% clarity that we're not going to do. But if you happen to make a mistake, then you can switch paradigms and say, okay, well, progress not to perfection. And how do I adjust the target? Now I forgot the original question.
Well, and that makes sense. And I like what you say there. Like, it starts really with commitment, and that the commitment builds the character. And I heard something one time, let's see if I can get this right, but it was looking at people with addictions, for example, let's take smoking. And there are people that said, I quit smoking. And so they've quit smoking, but they still identify with being a smoker that's quit smoking. And what the studies have shown are those that actually commit, that quit smoking for good, said, I'm not a smoker. So yes, they changed their identity in a way that they used to be a smoker that had the willpower not to, they're still a smoker that has the willpower not to smoke. And, right, and they really manage that, try not to go to bars with smoke and try not to hang out with friends that are smokers. And so it's this constant willpower. And then at some point, there's a point, you know, since they're still a smoker that just quit smoking, they get tempted again, and then they fall back, and there the pattern starts, and they might go a whole life, the start stop. But those that had the biggest success, meaning they quit smoking because they just identified, I'm not a smoker. So they could be in the smokiest environments, but because they're not a smoker, that's their character now. That's how they see, yes, themselves, as I'm a non-smoker. So is that something similar here? Is that I'm not somebody that eats chocolate on weekdays, or however you may phrase it?
Character trumps willpower. Character eliminates the need for willpower. And we're always building character. If you go into a diner and there's a $20 bill on the table because the waitress hasn't seen her tip, and she says, I'll be right back, I just have to get some menus. And there's no camera up front, there's nobody sitting nearby, other waiters are not going to see you. Do you take the $20 bill or not? Most everybody that I ask that question to says no, and I'll say, why not? And I'll say, because I'm not a thief. And I'll say, so in the face of pleasure, when you would be better off having committed a particular act, you've already decided as a matter of character that there are things that you will never do again. So, well, why can't you do that with food? Right? So what we're really doing in defining very clear rules for ourselves is building character. We're just delineating what that character is and what it isn't. And as you build character, it just becomes a part of you, and you don't have to think about it. People will sometimes complain to me that this is a lot of work in the beginning. And I'll say, well, it's a lot of work in the sense that learning how to drive is a lot of work, where you have to memorize the rules of the road. But once you know the rules of the road, they're just a part of you, and you can daydream or talk on the phone or listen to music. You don't have to think, oh my God, what do I do at a red light anymore? Or you know, who goes first at a four-way stop? You just know that reflexively. It's a part of who you are. And you're doing that whether you like it or not. I'm just advocating that we take more conscious control of the whole process. So character trumps willpower.
And awareness of self in a way that we know when we're in a place where we're maybe don't have as much quote unquote willpower, or we are in a certain state, an emotional state, and just being aware, I'm in this state. But my character, I'm going to go do the smoothie that's the green banana smoothie. And it's, again, like you said, it's an awareness and knowing, okay, I'm in this spot again, and I'm going to go back to my rule. It's probably, especially at the beginning, until you create new cravings, until we get attached to how good it feels or how much better it feels to be on the healthy side of the equation. That
exactly.
Many times you reach a point that even if you go back and have that binge, you feel so terrible. You realize like, I'm like, seriously, I'm not going to do that again. It feels so much better on this other side now that I know what that feels like.
I'd rather live with the memories than the actual experience.
That's good.
Might have seemed like a party when I was younger, but it doesn't seem like a party anymore.
And so if people are struggling with binge eating, what would, like, obviously they can come find you and you have work, but are there some tips? Are there something, like, what would you recommend for people to get started?
What I recommend is that you separate the weight loss phase from the control phase. Like, you need to teach yourself how to play this game, and that you do it in a very simple way. So think of one rule that would help you regulate your most dangerous food intersection, the most significant trigger of food behavior. For example, I know a guy, it doesn't have to restrict any food. I know a guy who lost 150 pounds because he started with Run Rule that said, I'll just never go back for seconds. And he only ate at fast food joints, and he got as much as he wanted in one trip to the counter, and he just never went back for seconds. And he could hear his inner pig trying to talk him into going back for seconds, but he was able to disempower it because he said, well, like, I can get whatever I want to next time. Like, I can do it tomorrow if I really want to. Just one rule. Sometimes it's not a rule about food. Sometimes it's a rule about a food behavior. Like, I'll never eat standing up again, or I'll never eat in the car again, or I'll never eat while I'm looking at my phone again. People want rules that support mindfulness. But what's one thing? There are four categories of rules to help you. There are things you never do again, things you'd always do, like I always eat six servings of fruit and vegetables every day, things that you do under certain conditions, like I only ever eat chocolate at a party or on the weekends, and then things that you can do in an unrestricted way just so that you don't worry that you're going to starve. So that's a way to think of the rules, and I'll give you some place where you can get a template and a couple of different ideas for it later on. And then listen very carefully for that voice inside you that says, no, you can't do this, or you shouldn't do this, or you won't be able to do this. Write down everything that voice says, and then ask yourself, well, where's the lie? Where's the lie in that? And try to disempower that voice. And you'll slowly start to notice that you have power where you thought you had none, that you have consciousness where you thought you had none. And if you can make that one rule, and if it helps you even one time to delay what would have otherwise been an automatic impulse, then you've just proven to yourself that you can reclaim your power. You've just proven to yourself that this is possible. You've proven to yourself that you can trust yourself and you can build on that. The other thing people are frightened of is the word never or always. And the reason we do that is because your lizard brain acts like a two-year-old. See, if I'm crossing the street with my two-year-old niece, I say, Sarah, you can never, ever, ever, ever cross the street without holding my hand. Never, ever, 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 ever. I don't start talking to her about how when she's a big girl, I'm going to teach her to look both ways, because I don't want her distracted by the possibility of darting out into the street, even if I tell her it's not for a couple of years. It's too dangerous. She's too small. She's too impulsive. Our lizard brains are like that. We have to treat it like two-year-olds, even though we know that maybe I'm going to change my food plan or change this rule later when I have more experience. You can change your plan whenever you want to. I recommend that you spend a half an hour writing out why you want to change it and make sure that it's really you and not your pig that wants to do that. And then have a 24-hour delay before you put it into effect. but you can change them anytime you want. You don't have to be frightened of the word never. Having the word never and again is what really makes it possible to eliminate the loopholes in your plan so that any voice that suggests that you're going to do this either now or in the future becomes your pig. And that's what gives you the opportunity to hear it and disempower it and ignore it.
I love that. You know, just listening to you reminds me that I used to have a really serious sweet tooth. I've always been into health and fitness and that type of thing, and never really any binging issues because I've been dedicated to a healthy lifestyle. But sugar was my nemesis in a way. And my first rule I created for myself was no dessert at restaurants, because I did a lot of entertaining with a lot of work and had a lot of dinners out. And especially dinners out, there'd always be dessert, or it's always the waiter always comes by and says, would you like dessert? And so that was my first rule, was no dessert out. And that was the first step. And then my second rule was, if I'm going to have dessert, I have to make dessert. So according to a healthy dessert cookbook, and I'm not going to go to the effort actually to make dessert except on rare occasions. So I really eliminated since that was my rule, I just cut so much dessert straight out right off the bat. And then two, that craving went away. The sugar craving really went away. And now I don't even crave dessert or sugar anymore. And I could be anywhere and it doesn't even look good. And I laugh because I'd be the one that would be eating the dessert. I would skip the dinner and just
get it. And your pig told you that you were going to die if you didn't have it.
Yeah, and they're just, that craving was so strong. But now that you're talking about it, it's like, oh yeah, I did create those rules. And then all of a sudden, those cravings completely went away. And now dessert's not even really an option, except on rare occasion. And so it's funny you say that. I never would have thought of that. Like, oh yeah, I did actually create those rules. And it was very effective.
There's a phenomenon called upregulation and downregulation. I know we're running short in a minute. There's a phenomenon called upregulation and downregulation. Your pig says you can't give up dessert, because you're going to feel too deprived. You're never going to have that pleasure again. But what actually happens is, if you have dessert on a regular basis, then an apple doesn't taste nearly as sweet because your taste buds downregulate. It's like you used to have an apartment underneath the subway, and I wondered how I was ever going to sleep. But after a week, you don't hear the subway anymore. Your brain adjusts. And it also goes the other direction. You stop sleeping underneath the subway, then you can suddenly hear the noises around you again. If you stop having desserts, your taste buds, I think they double in a matter of 48 weeks in sensitivity, so that the apples and bananas and fruits of the world taste much more rich and delicious to you again. So,
and that's right.
That's why the craving goes away. Yeah.
Well, right. And it's crazy how sweet things taste now. If I take a bite of something, oh my gosh, how did I even like that? Anyway, I know we're bumping up against our time. So to take care of you and your timing, I like to ask one final question for all of my guests. And I love to do a little myth busting here on the podcast for my unconventional non-traditionalists. So what in your profession and in your work, outside of what we've already talked about, or even if you wish to elaborate a little bit more, what is the myth that you bump against most often that you'd like to bust?
Addiction isn't a disease. Addiction is a choice.
Wow.
There's no evidence, even though it's been accepted by the medical society as, you know, listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It was by a show of hands, not because of a review of scientific evidence. And the notion that it's actually a disease and that you're powerless over the impulse is very damaging, because it makes you think that you can't quit if you want to. It gives justification to your pig to say, you can't help yourself. This is the only thing you can do. You're very sick. You're different than everybody else. You're not. You don't have a disease. What you have is a healthy appetite that's been corrupted by industry. That's the myth I'd like to bust, first and foremost.
Well, wow. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Glenn. I really appreciate your time. We'll make sure that all of your information is in the show notes and make it really easy for people to find you, connect with you, and anybody that struggles with binge eating, they now have a resource. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you can get a copy of the book for free at the site.
Okay, we will put that in the show notes as well.
Okay.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you, dear.
And so ends another episode of the Wealthy Wealthy Life podcast, where Christina brings you unconventional, cutting-edge strategies from leading experts to optimize your wealth and your health. As a token of gratitude for listening, go to podcast.fallingformoney.com and download a free copy of her best-selling book, Falling for Money. If you're ready to change your relationship with money, head on over to podcast.fallingformoney.com and download your free copy today.